I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 21st, and we have a lot to talk about. Pain and fatigue are two of the most common and challenging symptoms of MS, and what makes them doubly challenging and frustrating for people living with MS is the fact that both pain and fatigue are invisible symptoms. I don't think anyone needs to hear one more well-meaning friend or coworker explain that if they just got a little more sleep, they wouldn't feel so exhausted. But that's a conversation that way too many people with MS have to endure on a very regular basis. And the other aspect of pain and fatigue that make them such challenging symptoms is that these are the symptoms that can stop you from fully engaging in your life. At work, at home, with friends or family, pain and fatigue can get in the way. My guest today is Dr. Heidi Maloney. Dr. Maloney is a nurse practitioner and the National Clinical Nursing Director for the Multiple Sclerosis Center of Excellence East at the Veteran Affairs Medical Center in Washington, D.C. She heads up research and programs to further the understanding of MS and its impact on veterans while aiding in the development of treatments to manage the disease and its symptoms. And Dr. Maloney is an expert on treating pain and fatigue in MS. In fact, she's passionate about educating other healthcare professionals about the comprehensive management of pain in MS. Dr. Maloney is going to share some best practices for managing MS-related pain. We'll talk about some specific medications that can help manage MS-related pain. We'll get into the effectiveness of cannabis-based products for managing pain. And when we talk about fatigue with Dr. Maloney, we'll talk about how to get your friends and family to stop telling you that you're probably just tired and a nap will fix everything. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Heidi Maloney, there are a few other things that you should know about. A few weeks ago, I reported that the Trump administration submitted a brief to the United States Supreme Court, literally in the middle of the night, asking that the Affordable Care Act be completely eliminated. And in its place, well, so far they've recommended nothing. Even though I pointed out that my concern wasn't a partisan concern, some of you got in touch with me asking why I was wandering into a political discussion on a podcast about multiple sclerosis. So I want to clarify exactly what my concerns are when it comes to access to healthcare. Full disclosure, I'm an MS activist, and that means that I have a clear bias in favor of any legislative agenda that improves the quality of life for families affected by MS, and an equally clear bias against any legislative agenda that threatens the quality of life for families affected by MS. And I guess I can start from the premise that healthcare shouldn't be a partisan issue. I like to think that there isn't anyone in our government who wants to see families and individuals who are already living with the challenges of a chronic illness like MS to have to worry about whether they can see a doctor or afford the medicine that will improve their lives. Access to affordable health care is something that I think we can all agree on. So if there is a partisan aspect to the issue of health care, it ought to be in how we pay for and deliver that health care. And I can even respect those differences, even the ones that I personally might not agree with. What I can't respect is being in favor of simply eliminating access to health care. And when the current administration works so hard to repeal the Affordable Care Act without offering a plan that protects people with pre-existing conditions, that threatens nearly 1 million families living with MS in the United States and tens of millions of families living with other chronic conditions. So just to be clear, this isn't a partisan argument with me. If the president's party would introduce healthcare legislation that improved on what we currently have, I'd be one of the biggest cheerleaders. But in the 3+ years of this administration, well, that just hasn't happened. And I'm also very clear on the shortcomings of the Affordable Care Act. Well, that's why last month, the U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation that addressed several of those shortcomings, starting with premiums for individual health insurance policies that are just too high. This legislation would limit the cost of health insurance premiums to a maximum of 8.5% of a person's income. It also makes it easier for members of a family to purchase health insurance even when another family member can get coverage through their employer. The bill provides $200 million to create more state insurance exchanges because we've seen that state exchanges are more successful at signing up more people for health insurance. And the bill even provides $10 billion to help states protect insurance companies from the most expensive claims and to further subsidize their residents who purchase health insurance. Now, the political reality is that this bill will never be put to a vote in the Senate, so there's virtually no chance that it would find its way to the president's desk. But I mention this to point out something that often gets overlooked in our national conversation about healthcare. And that's the fact that improvements are made to existing laws all the time. Congress routinely passes legislation designed to fix shortcomings in our laws. But when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, the approach has somehow been different. Now, we've heard the president describe the Affordable Care Act as, quote, a disaster. And the only remedy that's ever been offered is to burn down access to health care in America. It's probably worth pointing out that in the 55 years since Medicare was passed into law, Congress has passed dozens of bills designed to make Medicare better, to improve on its shortcomings. Now, the conversation about improving our access to health care is always worth having, but as we're in the midst of the greatest health care crisis of our lifetimes, it becomes an even more important conversation. Between February and May of this year, 5.4 million American families have lost their health insurance due to job loss. It's the greatest decline in health insurance coverage, even greater than what we experienced in 2008 during the so-called Great Recession. And I think it's naive to assume that none of these 5.4 million families have someone at home battling a chronic illness. I've experienced firsthand how living with a serious chronic illness, specifically progressive MS, can wipe out a family's finances. And that was with what was considered excellent health insurance and pretty strong financial resources. I guess that's why this issue of access to affordable health care is such a hot-button topic for me. I've lived through the downside. So I'll continue advocating to ensure that people with pre-existing conditions are protected and have access to affordable health care and affordable prescription medications. And I'll continue reminding you of all the reasons that advocating on behalf of your own self-interest is important and even empowering. I'm not interested in protecting the Affordable Care Act because it needs fixing, but I'm less interested in simply blowing it all up without having something better in hand. And I promise you, there's absolutely nothing partisan in that vision. In last week's episode of Real Talk MS, I talked with Alexander Hardy, the CEO of Genentech, the manufacturer of Ocrevus. We covered a lot of ground during our conversation, and one of the things that Alexander brought up was the CHIMES study, a clinical trial that focuses on African American and Hispanic MS patients. This study is being designed to include input from African American and Hispanic MS patients in every aspect of the study itself, from recruitment strategies to the content of the materials being used in the study to the overall study design. This patient input is going to come from a patient advisory group. And if you're an African American or Hispanic MS patient, or a family member, caregiver, or advocate for someone who is, you can apply to participate as a member of this patient advisory group. The group will meet 4 to 6 times over an 8-month period. The meetings will be virtual until further notice, and members of the patient advisory group will receive a stipend in the range of $150 to $250 per meeting. If you'd like to apply to be a member of the patient advisory group for the CHIMES study, there's a very short questionnaire that you'll need to fill out, and you'll find a link to that questionnaire in today's show notes. It's also worth pointing out that we can expect to see more and more clinical trials putting patients and caregivers at the center, not just in terms of collecting data for a particular study, but having a voice and a vote in all of the decision-making that takes place in a research initiative, and that is a major step forward in improving the outcomes of future medical research. I'm always amazed when I see how people affected by multiple sclerosis find really creative ways to combine their personal passions with their desire to support MS research. Blake Arnett played his college basketball at UCLA, and in its first 2 years, Blake's annual fundraiser, Dunk MS, has already raised $80,000. This year, like so many other aspects of our lives, Dunk MS is going virtual, and that means that no matter where you may be living, you can catch the world's first virtual charity basketball dunk show and contribute to furthering MS research. We're going to talk about Dunk MS with its founder. Welcome to the podcast, Blake.
Hey, John. Great to be here.
I always remind my listeners that MS affects families, not just individuals. So I'm hoping you can share a little bit about how MS affected you and your family.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So my mom was diagnosed in 2007 when I was a junior in high school, and it was a drastic change. She went from, you know, the breadwinner of the family to not being able to drive, you know, in a short amount of time, maybe a few months. And then unfortunately, she passed away 2 years later in 2009. We believe she had symptoms before, but she only got diagnosed in 2007. So it was a big shock to the family. She was a rock to us all. She was my best friend. And I remember the day, you know, July 30th, 2009, like it was yesterday. But that's what drives me every day. But to answer your question about the family, it certainly affected us greatly. But, you know, we came together as a family. A lot of times families can come together or they can, you know, kind of fall apart, unfortunately. But in this case, we definitely all became closer. Our immediate family and our extended family to rally behind the tragedy of what happened to my mom. But I took this negative and turned it into a positive in Duncan S. So we're here today, 11 years later, and I'm super excited to see where we're going in the future with Duncan S.
You know, a lot of people do their fundraising by participating in events like Walk MS and Bike MS, but you came up with an event that showcases dunks from some of the world's top basketball dunkers. How did that all happen?
Yeah, so we were doing Walk MS and Bike MS as a family in Orange County and San Diego ever since 2010. And I thought to myself, this is now in 2017, with my background in basketball, in sports coaching, and in entrepreneurship, why don't I create my own event and raise as much money as possible? Now, I think we raised about a couple thousand dollars each year as a family. But I thought, you know, I can do so much more. Let me think of a unique event and bring my skill sets together, bring my network together to create something new and exciting. And so that's when I came up with the idea of having a dunk show with a kids basketball clinic and sponsor tables and really making a fun family atmosphere where we bring together the MS communities and the basketball communities. So I did about a year of research, a year of networking. And I came up with the idea, and we launched it in May 2018, and we raised $45,000 our first year, which blew my mind. So I had so much help, and you know, I'm doing this all part time and not taking a dime. So it's been really amazing to see what came from my idea in 2017 to where we are now in 2020.
Yeah, I said this when I introduced you, but it bears a second shout out. In its first 2 years, Dunk MS has already raised $80,000, which is incredibly impressive for a new fundraising event.
Yeah, I was shocked, John. I mean, so much love and help from my good friends, being on the volunteer team year-round, my friends' day of volunteering, families that I'm close to, family friends, and the MS community and the basketball community all coming together. So it's been awesome. Yeah, we'll see where it goes, but I'm super excited.
So let's talk about this year's virtual Dunk MS event. What are the details, Blake?
Yeah, definitely. So our goal here is to do a have our pro dunkers come back. They're going to pre-record their dunks. We're going to have those awesome dunk shows from our six pro dunkers, some of the top pro dunkers in the world. And then we're also going to have some dunk videos from amateur dunkers from across the world. This year is pretty unique. As you know, it's a virtual event. So I want to bring in as many people as we can to utilize our virtual event. So we'll have some awesome dunks from across the world. But again, this is also for MS research, right? So 90% of the funds goes to UCLA Health for MS research and Cedars-Sinai for MS research. So part of the event also includes MS warrior-focused content. So we're going to have other nonprofits, other MS community leaders speak as part of our event to get the word about what they're doing. And they will also have an MS expert Q&A session with Dr. Casey from Cedars-Sinai as well. So she'll answer some general MS questions as well as COVID-19 related questions as well. And last but not least, we'll have some raffle prizes for everyone too. So event tickets are free for everyone, but raffle tickets are $10 each. We have some awesome prizes like an iPad, 4 Disneyland tickets, a Tesla test drive, and so much more that you'll see online once we launch the event.
So how can people get involved? Where do they need to go? What do they need to do?
Definitely, yeah. So it's very simple. So they just go to dunkms.com, and I'll have the free attendee button right at the top of the website. They can simply register for free, and then hopefully they can donate and get some raffle tickets for a chance to win those. If they want to donate either their company or themselves personally, they can easily as well go to dunkms.com, and it'll have a donate button on the website as well.
I will definitely be part of that global audience tuned in on August 15th, 5 p.m. Pacific time for this year's virtual event. And before I let you go, I want to ask you about your MS Heart for Hope initiative. What's that all about?
Yeah, so our MS Heart of Hope initiative, that's something that I came up with last year. So I launched it actually 10 years to the day my mom passed. So I launched it July 30th, 2019. And the idea was, again, this is in honor of my mom, Bridget. She didn't have a support group back then besides her close family and friends. There weren't as many services, in our community back then. So, I thought to myself, I want to give someone, MS warrior, something physical that they can have to remind them that we're always with them in their fight against MS. So I created a 2-inch gold coin that has MS Heart of Hope around it and let them know that they're not alone in their fight. So the idea is I get companies to sponsor about 1,000 coins or a family sponsor. So they'll donate around $1,000 and I can create 250 coins from that donation. And once I get those physical Heart of Hope coins, I now partner with UCLA Health, with Cedars-Sinai, and whatever hospital that the donor wants. And I give those coins to those MS nurses and MS doctors. So when someone gets newly diagnosed or they come in for their checkup or a test, those doctors or nurses can give MS patients the Heart of Hope coin for free. So they're not for sale right now. I might have them for sale in the future, but right now they're only donation-based and we give them out for free at certain hospitals. So right now it's at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles and UCLA Health in Westwood.
And if someone listening is interested in sponsoring a 250 run of those MS Heart of Hope coins, where do they need to go? What do they need to do?
Great question, John. So we have it on our Dunk MS website. So they can go to dunkms.com/heartofhope. They can also search on the top part of our menu button on our website as well. And then I have a link where they can click on sponsor 250 coins and they can make their tax deductible donation for those coins. And also a great thing too, I'm going to raffle off 10 coins at Virtual Dunk MS. So someone can simply buy a $10 raffle ticket and they'll have a chance to win 10 coins at Dunk MS 2020 virtual.
Well, that sounds great. Now I'll be sure to include a link to the Dunk MS website in today's show notes. Make it easy for everybody. I have to tell you, Blake, what I love most about doing Real Talk MS is that it gives me an opportunity to meet real difference makers, folks who are actually moving the needle when it comes to advancing MS research. And Blake Arnett, you absolutely qualify as one of those difference makers. So thanks for all that you're doing to bring the world closer to a cure for MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Of course, my pleasure. And again, John, so everyone knows my life mission is to find a cure for MS in honor of my mom. and I won't stop until we get there. So we're doing this as a team, and I'm super excited to hopefully find a cure one day with everyone else.
Shift MS is a social network for people living with MS. They're based in the UK, and Shift MS has distinguished themselves by producing really outstanding, dramatic short films that illustrate some of the challenges that are faced every day by people living with MS. And our friends at Shift MS have just released their latest short film called Sidecar. In this film, they explore a subject that they describe as the thing that nobody with MS wants to talk about. And that's the effect of MS progression. And it's not just the physical effect. The film really focuses on the psychological burden that accompanies new disease activity and progression. Like all of their work, this short film is worth watching. And if you're interested in checking it out, you'll find a link in today's show notes. As someone who is an MS caregiver for more than 20 years, I think that a caregiver's observations and perceptions can help healthcare providers and researchers gain a more complete 360-degree view of the things that a patient experiences. Our friends at the Accelerated Cure Project for MS are conducting a survey to better understand caregiver relationships with healthcare providers. So if you happen to be an MS caregiver, or you know someone who is, I hope you'll encourage them to take a few minutes to complete this online survey. Caregivers can play a very important role in MS research, but only when they participate. And if you'd like to participate in this survey, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Pain and fatigue are two symptoms that are particularly challenging and frustrating for people living with MS. My guest today is Dr. Heidi Maloney. Dr. Maloney is an expert on managing these two invisible but potentially debilitating symptoms. And during our conversation, we'll cover some specific strategies that you can employ to better manage MS pain and MS fatigue. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Heidi Maloney. My guest today is Dr. Heidi Maloney. Dr. Maloney is a nurse practitioner and the National Clinical Nursing Director for the Multiple Sclerosis Center of Excellence East at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Washington, D.C. She heads up research and programs to further the understanding of MS and its impact on veterans while aiding the development of treatments to manage the disease and its symptoms. Dr. Maloney also serves as chairperson of the Institutional Review Board at the Washington, D.C. VAMC. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Maloney.
Thank you, John.
I've heard that you're passionate about educating other healthcare professionals about the comprehensive management of pain in MS. Pain is common, but it can be tricky to deal with. First, it's invisible. So while someone may be experiencing significant pain, people around them can't see that, and that is really an ongoing frustration for a lot of people who are living with MS. At the same time, although it may be one of those so-called invisible symptoms, pain can have a very significant impact on someone's quality of life. So, Dr. Maloney, what do we know about pain in MS, and how should people living with MS be approaching pain management?
That's a great question, John, and what we know about pain in MS is that it's central pain, meaning that the pain is caused by a lesion in the central nervous system. It's related to the multiple sclerosis. Now, that's one way of experiencing pain. Another way can be having lived with MS for a long period of time, when disability can cause musculoskeletal pain. So, for instance, the sitting in a wheelchair all day long can cause a little bit of pain on your backside, or the pain that it's experienced when you're trying to pull, a person with MS is trying to pull their leg through their gait, if there's some disability there, all the pain in the back that's experienced. So musculoskeletal pain and then central nervous system pain or neuropathic pain are the two types of pains that are experienced in MS. The most common pain complaints is back pain, painful spasms, spontaneous or pain or evoked pain in the extremities, kind of burning extremity pain, and headache. So neuropathic pain and headache are the most common pain syndromes that are experienced by people with MS. And I might just add here that, you know, pain is a sensory experience. So it's something you feel. But when it reaches the brain, it's something that's interpreted by the individual. And that interpretation can have a lot of impact on the experience of pain, how severe it is, how intense it is. So that interpretation by the brain is really, really important. And a patient suffering pain, a person with MS suffering pain, can modulate that perception of pain to minimize the pain experience.
What are some of the common medications that someone can turn to help manage pain?
The common medications are grouped into classes, and one of the classes is anti-epileptic drugs. And within that class are common medications that patients are very used to, gabapentin or Neurontin, pregabalin or Lyrica, levetiracetam, topiramate or Topamax. These are commonly used to manage pain because just like epilepsy, which is erratic firing of nerves, pain is seen as that as well. And so these anti-epileptic drugs work on neurotransmitters to minimize that experience of pain. Other classes of medications would be antidepressants. And the antidepressants increase norepinephrine and serotonin and dopamine, neurotransmitters within the brain, to modulate that experience. So this is another way the brain then can turn the signals of pain around and modulate that experience of pain to minimize the pain. Maybe not make it go away, but minimize it. Tricyclic antidepressants, nortriptyline, amitriptyline, these are medications that have some more severe side effects than the SSRIs or SNRIs, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and those would be Paxil, paroxetine, fluoxetine, Prozac, but duloxetine, venlafaxine, these are names, but the tricyclic antidepressants, nortriptyline and amitriptyline, are very good pain medications, often given at night, best used at night so that you can minimize some of the side effects like low blood pressure or sleepiness. One of the side effects of those drugs is a little bit of a dry bladder. And that can be a benefit for folks taking those medications at night because I think of it as a twofer. It'll keep you asleep, not rushing off to the bathroom, and also manage your pain. It's very good for headache type pain. So those classes of medications.
There's also been some research, not a lot yet, but some research that has shown that people living with MS have started to turn to CBD or cannabidiol as an effective means of trying to manage their MS pain. But CBD isn't without its caveats. What's your advice when it comes to CBD or cannabis-based products?
Well, use with caution. We don't have enough studies to really look at the long-term effects of CBD, you know, over time. You know, how is it affecting someone? We know some of the side effects, you know, the sleepiness, the dizziness, sometimes nausea that are associated with CBD. We know that cannabidiol, which is CBD, that portion of marijuana is the non-psychoactive portion, and it can cause some sleepiness, and it even can cause a little bit of dependence. But the THC, which is the psychoactive component, and both of those can affect pain, and we know that there are studies that patients say they affect their pain and studies that show that they are effective for pain management, but we don't know over the long term if those studies are effective or what their side effects might be, and we've never compared them to prescriptive pain medications like gabapentin or Lyrica. We've never actually done some head-to-head trials to see which is the better modality. Is CBD a better modality? And then I must add a caution when someone has a medical marijuana prescription. And they go, you know, 33 states in the District of Columbia are offering medical marijuana cards that are given by physicians, and that affords that person the ability to go to a vendor and purchase marijuana for medical purposes. And MS is one of those medical purposes that's approved. When you go to that vendor, what is the dose? Can you assure the dosing? Can you assure the concentration of the drug from time to time, from bottle to bottle, from prescription to prescription? And then patients tell me that, you know, they might get marijuana that helps them sleep, you know, specifically billed to help them sleep, or marijuana that helps with pain, or marijuana that's specific for a certain symptom. But knowing what's in that preparation of seeds and leaves is left not to science. It's not left to science, and there's no regulatory body to regulate it, like the FDA will regulate drugs and make sure that what's in that drug is what it says on the label. So when you get marijuana that says, or CBD that says it's for pain, how much do you know is in that? And that's the risk. And then also the cost of it is a risk if it's not really doing you any good. My last thing I want to say is that you should always let your provider know that this is something that you are using to manage pain, how it's helping you manage pain, and that it is managing pain. And providers are going to be very cognizant of the fact that that is helping you and will want to continue supporting you in that as long as it's safe. So having that conversation affords the safety factor.
I'm wondering, is there a relationship between pain and other MS symptoms like mood or fatigue?
Oh, I would say absolutely. And I see it as a circle that pain begets poor mood and can beget depression. So people in pain sometimes are irritable, and I call it cranky. So they may not have a lot of folks around them, or they may isolate. And isolation is the worst thing that anyone can do in any circumstances. Not having activities around you, or friends around you, or people around you to create a happy world just increases that risk of greater depression and greater mood. So pain does have influence mood. And mood, again, can probably influence, not probably, it does. There are studies that show that mood can make pain worse, because you are thinking of that pain, thinking of how bad that pain can be and how much it's never going to be better. And when you get into that cycle, when a person gets into that cycle of thinking, my gosh, I'll never manage this, it will never go away, there's a catastrophe involved in that kind of thinking. And the more you think about it, the heavier it gets, and the more it snowballs into poor mood, anger, lashing out at others, and then further depression. So yes, they're all wrapped up, and they all need to be recognized and addressed.
Well, since I just mentioned fatigue a moment ago, fatigue is one of the most common MS symptoms. It's another one of those invisible symptoms, and it's another one of those symptoms that can absolutely stop someone from fully engaging in other areas of their life. So I'd like to talk about fatigue for just a moment. How is MS-related fatigue different from, I guess, what I'll call non-MS fatigue? And how can people get their friends, family, and coworkers to stop telling them that they're just tired?
Right. So those are two questions. And for the first question, how is it different from regular fatigue? MS fatigue has a tendency to be constant. It has a tendency to affect activities of daily living where folks can't participate. It has a tendency to always be there without exercise or an activity that would, in general, in another situation or in a normal person, cause tiredness. So everyone can remember exercising and being tired after that exercise, but that tiredness goes away. So in a sense, that's how they differ. Their usual fatigue can come from exercise after a period of exercise, and then it goes away. But with MS, it doesn't usually do that. And your question about how to help family members recognize that they're not just getting away with not doing the dishes by saying they're tired, but to understand that this isn't a fault, that this is a symptom. And I think a serious conversation, sitting down with a family and having maybe a family discussion at the dinner table, or bringing a family member into your provider to discuss fatigue, or maybe offering pamphlets such as the MS Society offers to have the family member read, to recognize that this fatigue is relegated to an MS lesion in the central nervous system, but that's exactly why it's happening. There are parts of the brain and the spinal cord where cytokines are activated, where parts of the brain like the hypothalamus is activated, that regulate rest and relaxation in the brain, and those are affected by the MS lesions. So the person can't help it. It's physiologic. So I think, John, I'll just mention here that I often think of fatigue as a sonata, where it has three parts. One part is the physiologic part, where there are lesions in the central nervous system. And the second part is just the fatigue that comes from deconditioning, just being weak and deconditioned and needing to bring yourself up to a level of conditioning. Physical therapists certainly help with that. Heat sensitivity is part of that second part of the sonata. Respiratory muscle weakness is also part of fatigue. If you're not breathing heavily, or not heavily, and breathing deeply or fully, you're going to feel tired. And then the third part is all the other stuff that goes along with instigating or promoting fatigue in a person, and that's medications. What medications is the person taking? Are they taking antidepressants? Are they taking hypertensive drugs? Are they taking antihistamines, which can promote fatigue? Is there depression going on? Is there an illness? Is there infection going on? Is there increased, like I said, ambient temperatures that occur with infections? Sleep. What is the sleep? And pain again can impact fatigue. Nutrition, poor intake of water throughout the day, can, all of that is part of the third part of the sonata that is part of stimulating fatigue.
Let's talk for just a moment about ways to bring that sonata to a satisfactory end. Are there strategies that our listeners can use to help them manage their MS-related fatigue?
Yes, absolutely. And I would start out by suggesting energy conservation. So when you get up in the morning, look at your day and what's happening throughout the day. What are the demands? What are things that you can not do? What are demands that you can have other people take care of? Prioritizing your activities. What should I do first? And maybe not do when you wake up, you might feel it at your best. And the tendency is to get a whole lot done at the beginning of the day. Well, that may just drain you and you'll have nothing left for the rest of the day. So conserve that energy and prioritize the tasks and stretch them out over the whole day, so that by dinner time, you have enough energy to help your kid with the homework, or read a bedtime story, or supervise baths, or even cook. So that's part of energy conservation. And then doing things in energy conservation, like sitting down to take a shower. Why stand when you can sit? Why reach when you can scoot over and pull something? You know, have a wheeled stool in the kitchen where you could just move from place to place on wheels, rather than walk from place to place. Have things low and at good height for you. And then the next thing would be to recharge, rest and recharge, sleep, have little power naps throughout the day, set your clock for 10 minutes, don't oversleep, because then you maybe will feel overtired and can't wake up. But just little power naps, and then do pleasurable activities. Put on some soft music, some really soothing and nice music that's restful. Watch a restful television show, or maybe do a little bit of mindfulness to kind of relax and rest, or yoga techniques that you can sit and take 10 minutes to just do those sorts of things. And then lastly, cooling. So cooling behaviors, making sure that your body is at a cool temperature, even inside and outside, wearing a cooling vest, cooling neck apparatus, and a hat and sunglasses when you're going out. Take a water bottle, fill it with water that you would spritz a plant with that has a spritz capacity, put it in the fridge or the freezer, get it nice and cold, and use it over your body, because convection is one of the fastest ways of expending heat from your body to manage that fatigue. Exercise and nutrition I want to talk about as techniques to manage. Exercise should be done, because there are plenty of studies that indicate that exercise actually helps fatigue. Now, I know patients have said to me, oh, when I exercise, I'm absolutely drained. Because I think they might think of themselves as weekend warriors, where they're doing everything at once and then they're so exhausted and floppy they can't manage. Exercise should be done no more than 5 minutes when you're first starting. So you're going to get on a cycle or do some aerobic exercise, no more than 5 minutes. Build that up over time. Do it every other day, not every day of the week. Combine aerobic exercise with stretching exercises. And then not just stretching, but weightlifting, some small weights, even soup cans. Just resistance training exercises are always helpful. Alternate those with aerobic exercise and work up to a situation of 30 minutes a day. Find a time, make a commitment, I'm going to do this. And when you start, it might be a time in the morning or lunchtime, but you pick a time when you're deciding. You set the goals, mark it on a calendar, mark it in a book. And if you can make it for 3 months with this kind of slowly escalating exercise, and you can do it for 3 months, it's a habit and you'll do it forever. Lastly, healthy behaviors, making sure you get enough sleep. As I said, good nutrition and good fluid habits, taking in fluids. These are all strategies to manage fatigue.
Well, Dr. Heidi Maloney, thank you for all that you do every day to improve the lives of our veterans and to make sure that they're receiving the very best MS care. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks, John. It's been a great pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/151. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and, in some cases, multiplied the challenges of living with MS, from having difficulty affording MS medications, to adjusting to increased isolation, to coping with the loss of your health insurance, not to mention the added uncertainty of wondering how you or your family might be personally affected by COVID-19. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. So they've established the National MS Society COVID-19 Response Fund to ensure that the Society can continue meeting the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times. During the pandemic, we've seen the MS Society create virtual programming and support groups literally on the fly so that no one has to face MS alone. They've created resources and provided information so that doctors and nurses can deliver the very best care. They've continued to amplify the voices of the MS movement to influence critical public policy decisions. And they've never stopped advancing research to find cures for MS. I know that these are financially tough times for a lot of people, but I'm asking that as you're able, please make a donation to support the National MS Society. To donate, you can text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. Or if you prefer, I've created an online shortcut to get you to that same webpage, so you can visit realtalkms.com/COVID-19 Response Fund and make your donation. And you'll find that link in today's show notes. However you choose to contribute, please contribute today. It's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.